Today is Friday, November 27th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump says he will leave the White House.
Oh, certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that.
Also ahead, Taiwanese parliamentarians throw punches and pig guts.
Some of the legislators started a brawl, and part of that brawl involved throwing pig innards and pig skin and perhaps other things.
Plus, a Senegalese artist addresses violence against women. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in France, where video showing French police beating a black man has sparked widespread outcry at a time when President Emmanuel Macron's government is considering new limits on the ability to film police. The Interior Minister has suspended the officers involved. For more on this developing story, I reached out to Catherine Field in Paris. Catherine, there are images of the victim's bloodied face, and then there are these videos of the assault which have gone viral. What did these videos capture?
They capture images of police punching and kicking this music producer as he was returning to his studio. They were hitting him over the head and the body with their truncheons. We are told, but we can't hear it, that there were racial insults against him as well.
And what's the public response been?
Publicly, there's been outrage, partly because it has been so obvious. People have always hidden behind the fact that there was never the evidence. But now there is the evidence out there, and the fact that it is the third such incident within a week. Certainly the most public response has been from French football players. They have come out and they've condemned this sort of police brutality. And Mbappe, who's one of the young stars of French football, has come out and he said it's unbearable, this sort of unbearable violence, and said, you know, this is racism and it's got to stop. And in fact, the photo of this music producer who was assaulted by police has absolutely gone viral, not just on social media, but it's also on the front pages of the French press.
You mentioned previous incidents. What were those?
We had two incidents on Monday night in Paris when police went in to clear a migrant protest in the center of Paris, the Place de la République. Police there are under investigation for assaulting a migrant who'd taken part in that demonstration. And alongside of it, they're also being investigated by prosecutors, as well as their own police investigations, of attacking a journalist who was filming the incidents that were going on. We've also got, at the same time, several incidents that relate to earlier this year when police violence against people when they were arresting them. That's also going through the courts. And on the one hand, you've got the government saying, look, this is not the whole police force. This is just, if you like, a few bad eggs. But an editorial in the French newspaper Le Monde says very clearly, no, this is not just a few policemen. And I'm quoting here, it says it's a crisis of the leadership in the police force.
Now, this has also taken place while there is a proposed law in France to actually bar journalists, regular citizens, anyone from filming police in a way that can identify individual officers. The Interior Minister has said this law is meant to prevent terrorist attacks. But what's been the wider response to this law?
That particular law caused an enormous stir, and this weekend there were dozens of demonstrations planned for across France protesting this new law. As a way to sort of cut off those protests, the Prime Minister had suggested that it would go to an external commission of inquiry to look at the wording of this particular legislation. But in fact, even that has backfired because Parliament and Parliamentary Speaker has come out publicly and said, no, laws in this country are not reviewed by external commissions. They are reviewed by parliamentary commissions of inquiry. We have the structures there in place. Stop undermining Parliament.
And looking at French President Emmanuel Macron, today he said he was very shocked by the video of the beating of this music producer. How is Macron handling all of this police brutality?
Up until the statement that we heard that the president is shocked by this, he really hasn't got involved. He's left it to the prime minister and the Ministry of the Interior to order various investigations into this police violence. The backdrop to all of this is there has been a shift in French politics in the last year that has shifted slightly more to the right, away from the centre, because President Macron is facing re-election within the next 2 years, and he feels that he needs to attract more voters from the right wing. So there's been this shift to the right. I think now President Macron is seeing that this shift to the right has consequences, particularly in the Interior Ministry. There's been much more focus on law and order, appealing to the police to get tough on crime. And so that's where you've been seeing perhaps the Interior Minister not being tough enough on earlier allegations of police brutality. There's been a lot of allegations against the head police officer, the préfet de police here in Paris, that he hasn't been keeping his forces not just under control, but operating within the law.
That's journalist Catherine Fields in Paris. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. You take care, Jason.
We now have some breaking news from Iran. An Iranian scientist long suspected by the West of masterminding a secret nuclear bomb program was killed in an ambush near Tehran today. State media reported that Mozan Fakhrizadeh died of injuries in a hospital after gunmen fired on his car. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said on Twitter, quote, "Terrorists murdered an eminent Iranian scientist today. This cowardice, with serious indications of Israeli role, shows desperate warmongering of perpetrators," end quote. He also called on the international community to, quote, "end their shameful double standards and condemn this act of state terror," end quote. The Israeli government has not yet commented on Zarif's accusation that it had a role in Fakhrizadeh's death. Hossein Degan, military advisor to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, vowed on Twitter to, quote, "strike as thunder," end quote, against the perpetrators. The late Fakhrizadeh had long been described by Western countries as a leader of a covert atomic bomb program, which ended in 2003. Israel and the United States accused Tehran of trying to restore the program in secret. Iran has long denied seeking to weaponize nuclear energy. Please visit voanews.com for updates on this breaking story. U.S. President Donald Trump told reporters late Thursday that he will leave the White House if the Electoral College finalizes the results of the presidential election in favor of President-elect Joe Biden. In what usually amounts to a formality in the U.S. election process, a group of 538 electors from the 50 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. meet in December to officially choose the winner. Biden is projected to win 306 Electoral College votes, well above the 270 needed to win a presidential election. Here's Trump speaking with reporters.
So, no, I can't say that at all. I think it's a possibility. They're trying to look between you people. Don't talk to me that way. You're just a lightweight. Don't talk to me that way. I'm the president of the United States. Don't ever talk to the president that way. All right, I'm going to go with another question. Go ahead.
So if the Electoral College does elect President-elect Joe Biden, are you not going to leave this building?
Just so you... certainly I will. Certainly I will. And you know that. But I think that there will be a lot of things happening between now and the 20th of January. A lot of things.
During the press conference, Trump repeated his baseless claims of widespread voter fraud. In Taiwan, members of parliament threw punches and pig guts during a chaotic session over imports of U.S. meat products to the island. For more, I reached out to Ralph Jennings in Taipei. Ralph, thank you for joining us. What happened today in Taiwan's parliament?
My understanding is that our premier here, Su Jiangtang, was going to give a speech about health and meat products and everything connected to that, and possibly more. And then some of the legislators who don't like him because they're from an opposition party started a brawl, which they've done periodically for years and years and years in Taiwan history. And part of that brawl involved throwing pig innards and pig skin and perhaps other things. And then ultimately they stopped him from speaking for a while until some of his more supportive lawmakers kind of came around and joined the fray, if you will.
You mentioned there have been fights in Parliament for years and years. Why is that?
The history of brawls goes back to legislators believing that if they can fight on TV, that the viewers will think that they're really strong on the issues, really tough in terms of their policy, in terms of their commitment to certain things. A lot of these brawls are organized. In other words, they're staged. So if you're the person who's going to hit somebody, or you're the person who's going to be hit, you know about it in advance, and there's really no hard feelings. The TV stations are there. They get it all on film, and then apparently the voters really like it.
Now, looking at the issue itself, this brawl was over a proposal to allow meat imports into Taiwan from the U.S. Why does this issue raise such strong emotions?
So the pork lobby is big here. And for a long time, Taiwan has not allowed pork and some kinds of beef because there's this perception it has like a feed additive in the pork. And then that's the reason for not letting it come in. But then Taiwan really wants to start talking about a free trade agreement with the United States. And to do that, the United States would eventually ask Taiwan to allow pork imports and perhaps other agricultural products to come over this way. So the government here had preempted that and said, hey, we're going to allow that to happen. Apparently, the opposition party, which used to be the ruling party in parliament, had come up with this idea before, but they weren't able to get away with it. So now it just looks a little ironic because what happened to their proposal to allow meat imports at some time in the past.
And there were also some pretty large protests over this issue as well, correct?
Yes, on Sunday, 10,000, 20,000 came out as part of a protest against multiple issues. They brought up the pork imports among that, saying it would be hurtful to local agriculture.
So how might this be resolved?
What the government can do is add some stimulus to pork farmers, like they've done with lots of other people because of COVID-19 impacts. They can extend stimulus to them if they want to, and then that protest voice would presumably die down and they could move on. There's a lot of support here for a free trade deal between Taiwan and the U.S., so that voice may drown out those of the pork farmers anyhow.
And last of all, any word on what happens next in Parliament itself? Have they been able to clean up all the pig entrails and make it safe to go back and work there?
Yeah, I assume nobody slipped and fell on anything. So cleanups after brawls are common. I'm sure whoever's in charge of custodial services used to that kind of a mess and worse.
That's journalist Ralph Jennings in Taipei, Taiwan. Ralph, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed told three African Union envoys Friday that he has ruled out dialogue with the leaders of the defiant Tigray region. But Abiy said he was willing to talk with Tigray representatives who were, quote, operating legally, end quote. Abiy met with former Presidents Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, Joachim Chissano of Mozambique, and Galema Motlanthe of South Africa. But as the meeting took place, more people fled Tigray's capital city, Mekele, ahead of Abiy's promised final phase of the Ethiopian army's offensive. Meanwhile, the AP reports that the number of people managing to cross the border into Sudan has slowed to a trickle, raising fears that they are being blocked from leaving. Both sides in the three-week conflict are accused of targeting civilians. This is VOA. Australia's second largest state of Victoria has recorded no new coronavirus infections or deaths in the past 28 days, health officials said today. The state did not have any active cases after the last patient was discharged from the hospital Monday, while Victoria has achieved the 28-day benchmark, which is widely accepted by health experts as eliminating the virus from the community. Cases of the coronavirus have been detected in other parts of Australia. Meanwhile, Britain has asked its medicines regulator today to assess Oxford University and AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine candidate for temporary supply. The pharmaceutical company expects to distribute 4 million doses by the end of the year. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Journalists in Britain say they are facing an increasingly hostile atmosphere, with intimidation, physical assault, and online abuse now seen as routine and part of the job. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain's National Union of Journalists surveyed its members on their experiences of intimidation and abuse. More than three quarters of respondents agreed that it has become normalised and seen as part of the job. Some 51% reported receiving abuse online, with women and ethnic minorities particularly targeted. Michelle Stanistreet is Secretary General of the National Union of Journalists.
If you're being threatened with rape, if you're being threatened with grotesque violence, if your family members, your children are being threatened over social media, you can't simply think, don't feed the trolls, don't engage with it. You have to take those threats very seriously. And even if you weren't, the very fact that this content is appearing in your life, in your home, is incredibly unsettling, and it's affecting people's mental health and their well-being.
One in five respondents said they had been physically attacked. Journalists in Northern Ireland reported increasing threats and assaults. The killing of 29-year-old Lyra McKee, who was shot dead as she reported on rioting in the city of Derry in 2019, underlined the ongoing dangers that journalists face in the region. Many respondents said that abuse and intimidation had worsened under the coronavirus pandemic, especially during public demonstrations and protests. Again, Michelle Stanistreet.
Having their camera equipment targeted and damaged, and in some instances being physically assaulted.
Many of those surveyed blamed politicians for stoking a hostile climate for media. Again, Michelle Stanistreet.
Some of the rhetoric we've seen targeting the work of journalists, dismissing stories that don't meet with their approval as fake news, attacking so-called campaigning newspapers. It's made the climate, I feel, very much, particularly challenging for people who are simply trying to do their jobs.
The British government says it is considering new legislation requiring social media companies to take responsibility for threatening and abusive material on their platforms. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Women's rights activists in Senegal say gender-based violence has increased during COVID-19. To raise awareness for this week's International Day of the Elimination of Violence Against Women, Senegalese artist Diart exhibits her own experience. Estelle Janjo reports from Dakar.
47 years old Senegalese painter Diart, who only wishes to be identified by her artist name, is a survivor of gender-based violence. The mother of two was born with two clubbed feet, a disability that made it hard for her to protect herself from her violent husband. Diart eventually divorced and uses her paintings to show the attacks and social stigma against abused women. She says she identifies with these paintings. I don't take the suffering of another, says Diart, but I take my own suffering. I'm trying to represent on a canvas, she says. So, through my brushes, my painting, as a committed artist, says Diart, it is my duty to raise awareness, but it is also my duty to denounce. Activists say gender-based violence has increased globally during COVID-19 restriction, and Senegal is no exception. Activist DDDD created the website Violence Against Women in Senegal after a close friend was killed by her husband. During the COVID-19 lockdown, she says, the platform has been flooded with messages from women in need. Didi says all the cases she received are women being kicked out of their homes by their husbands. They do it just to make life harder for their wives, she says. They do it just before the curfew to raise awareness of the abuse for this year's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. On November 25, Diart is showing her work at Dakar's House of Urban Culture. As the event's opening Tuesday, the centrally located art gallery was filled with women looking at her paintings. which depict traditional scenes of women who are bloodied and bruised. University student Adama So praised the work for raising discussion on gender-based violence. She says this is a very good initiative because women need help. They don't need to be hit and mistreated, says So. They need attention and to be listened to. Dayalt's painting will be on display throughout the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, an annual international campaign from November 25 until December 10, Human Rights Day. Estelle Janjo for VOA News, Dakar.
In Pakistan, transgender lawyer Nisha Rao was once a beggar on the streets of Karachi. Now she's in the city's courts fighting cases of harassment. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Nisha Rao strides confidently into Karachi's city courts. She's one of many lawyers working in Pakistan's largest city. But Rao is unique in her own right. She's the country's first transgender lawyer and has fought against the odds to get to where she is. Now she wants to help her community in court.
I deal mostly with harassment cases for both women and transgender people. So far, I've appeared in court in more than 50 cases. I've represented more than 20 transgenders and got relief for them.
Rao never felt like she fitted in when she was young and ran away from her middle-class home in Lahore at the age of 18. When she arrived in Karachi, the transgender community with which she sought refuge advised her to beg on the street or become a sex worker to survive. Rao did beg and used the money to pay for evening classes, earning her law degree earlier this year after years of study.
I faced many problems during my law education. I did not have money for books and college fees, so I had to back at traffic signals on the streets during the daytime and take classes in the evening.
According to a 2017 census, there are more than 10,000 transgender people living in Pakistan. Their rights groups put the number much higher. They often face persecution despite a law passed in 2018 granting them special status with equal rights to other citizens. As for Rao, she has even bigger aspirations than being an attorney. Her goal is now to become Pakistan's first transgender judge.
That was Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer Nadia Taha and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While the ISIS so-called caliphate in Iraq and Syria has been decimated, the United States continues to be concerned by the rise of ISIS and its affiliates in other regions. In November, the United States and Nigeria convened a virtual meeting with members of the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, with representatives of West African states and relevant regional organizations to discuss the threat ISIS presents. U.S. Special Envoy to the coalition, Nathan Sales, said the meeting represented a significant pivot of the coalition to one of the most important fronts in the fight. While we must and will remain focused on preventing the resurgence of ISIS in the core of Iraq and Syria, we must also address ISIS's focus on using its branches and networks outside the core as the platforms from which to continue fighting, Special Envoy Sales said. Nowhere has this trend been as alarming as in Africa. If we are committed to ISIS's global defeat, and we are, we have to confront it in Africa, and particularly in West Africa. Special Envoy Sales pointed out that attacks in West Africa by ISIS-affiliated groups have significantly increased in volume and lethality over the past years. But the good news, he said, is that the global coalition has demonstrated that it is flexible and capable of adapting and responding to an evolving threat. While he noted that each battle against ISIS must be fought on its own terrain, the coalition has developed a culture of coordination across civilian and military lines of effort and bilateral and multilateral initiatives that can complement other counterterrorism initiatives in the region. Special Envoy Sales emphasized that however the global coalition decides to contribute to the de-ISIS fight, it will be important to make improving security forces' respect for human rights a key component of our efforts. Human rights abuses perpetrated by security forces, he noted, directly contribute to to terrorists' ability to radicalize, recruit, and discredit government legitimacy. Since 2017, the American people have invested more than $114 million in counterterrorism assistance in the wider region encompassing the G5 Sahel and Lake Chad Basin. Special Envoy Sales highlighted the U.S. plan to contribute over $30 million more over the next year. Our common fight against ISIS threats in West Africa, he emphasized, is a critical effort that the United States is committed to support.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.